May it please the court, Liam Curry again, representing the Commonwealth in this matter, as the appellant. I'd like to take the time in this case to address the trial court's kind of automatic application of the exclusionary rule and address some of the confusion that the court's ruling had in what exactly the court's ruling was. First, it's clear from the trial court's letter opinion and its order that it issued afterwards that the trial court simply found that the defendant's constitutional rights were violated and then ceased any analysis. The letter opinion states that the detective's warrantless search of the residence violated the Fourth Amendment, and any evidence resulting from that search is inadmissible. That's, I believe, in Mr. Cockrell's, the appendix in Mr. Cockrell's case, I believe that's on page 222. The court's order, however, states that the court finds that the search of the defendant's residence and the seizure of evidence therefrom violated the defendant their rights under the Fourth and Fourteenth Amendments of the United States Constitution. That's appendix page 233.
Mr. Curry, can you get closer to your microphone? We're losing you.
I apologize. Just to quickly restate the argument, is that in the letter opinion, the court seems to suppress evidence that was derived from the Fourth Amendment violation, which presumably is the officer's entry into the residence and the protective sweep within the residence. However, as counsel has noted, there was no evidence that was discovered or seized pursuant to that entry into the house. It's unquestioned that the evidence, mostly the marijuana evidence, was obtained under a search warrant that was valid, unchallenged, and supported by probable cause.
But I think that's the problem in the case, counsel, is that as the case was presented at the trial court, it was a protective sweep case.
Yes.
Once you all lost, once the government lost on the protective sweep analysis with the trial judge, the case turned into a search warrant case. And I think the concern, at least I have, is what analysis or analytical framework are we supposed to be applying here? The protective sweep analysis or the search warrant analysis, or can we apply either one or both?
Your Honor, I think that gives me some further clarity on your question and the previous matter. I think the way I have considered this case is that it's alternative arguments. So on one hand, the Commonwealth prevails if it can show that the entry and the protective sweep were lawful. In the alternative, the Commonwealth, because in that case there would be no unlawful police conduct that would violate constitutional rights, so there would be no basis for suppression. In the alternative, the argument was made by the Commonwealth in the trial court that there was probable cause to search the residence and that the trial court found that there was probable cause. The court found that the detectives had the ability to obtain a warrant well before the planned welfare check, immediately prior to their entry to the home upon smelling marijuana. So there's two different bases of probable cause.
Mr. Curry, can I ask you to address that first question? I mean, don't you lose on the protective sweep argument because the trial court made a finding? And forget about the fact that no one was arrested, whether we call it a protective sweep or exigent circumstances. The trial court made a finding that the police had no evidence or suspicion that there was anybody else in the house, no reason to believe that, that there was nothing that presented a threat to them, that there was nobody that was going to destroy evidence. Once the court made that finding, doesn't that pretty much preclude application of protective sweep exigent circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I would concede that the protective sweep issue is the weaker of the Commonwealth's two positions that are being argued here in the alternative. I do think that there is an argument that can be made that the officers did have a reasonable suspicion, which is not a particularly high standard, that the area could harbor a dangerous individual. And that suspicion would have been based on what, at the time the officers arrived, was a seemingly a confirmed presence of a high volume of illegal substances. because the odor of marijuana was detectable from either outside or from the public roadway, where what have you. The officers testified to a well-established link between the gun trade and firearms. They testified that based on what they observed at the time, they thought that that meant that there would be a high probability that weapons were involved or would be found in the residence. And they also had the fact that they smelled marijuana when they arrived at the residence seemed to confirm that it seemed to corroborate the tips that they had received that that Mr. Cockrell had been growing or manufacturing illegal substances in the home, and that he was in the home in the presence of the children in violation of the court order.
The trial court found, frankly, based upon the testimony of the police officers, that there was no evidence that there was anyone in the home other than the woman, the mother.
Yeah, Your Honor, I would just say that the strongest argument that the Commonwealth can make is that it was reasonable for the officers to conclude that Smith was lying to the officers about Cockrell's not being present in the residence, and that because he was manufacturing drugs and he was involved in the illegal manufacture of drugs, that he may have been hiding in the residence to avoid detection from law enforcement, and that he could be potentially in the residence to defend his illegal product using deadly force.
So, Mr. Curry, I think it might be productive to move on to more of the discussion about the search warrant.
Okay, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. So I think what we have here is based on the kind of the search warrant here was supported by the tips from an anonymous caller. We have the statements from the father that come from his children and from the odor of the marijuana. And as the court noted, even if you take away the odor of marijuana, there's still sufficient basis for the magistrate to issue the search warrant based on probable cause.
And is any of that altered by the trial judge's letter opinion or anything in the trial judge's letter opinion?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Judge Secker.
Well, in the context of this being a Commonwealth's appeal and you being the appellant and us being bound by the factual findings of the trial court, is there anything in the letter opinion that would alter that assessment?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the letter opinion confirms that the officers had probable cause to believe that illegal activity was present in the residence. That's appendix page 220. Earlier on appendix page 216, the trial court found that the officers had probable cause at the time entry was requested. All of those findings are consistent with the Commonwealth's position that the police lawfully obtained probable cause from an independent source.
Mr. Curry, if we can all agree that the primary purpose of the Fourth Amendment is to deter bad police conduct, I think that's the rote answer to any law school examination that you have. And if your position is that the Commonwealth had sufficient basis for a search warrant even before entering the property, why should we allow the Commonwealth the opportunity through its law enforcement agents to essentially snoop around and try to find other things without the search warrant? I think that's the problem that some of us are having here.
Well, I think we have to look at the principles that support the independent source doctrine. The independent source doctrine renders evidence admissible when it's discovered independently of police violation, of any police violations or misconduct. The idea is that the courts have determined that by doing a balancing test of the competing interests, one competing interest being that we want to deter unlawful police conduct. There's also a competing public interest that juries should have access to evidence, and in this case, highly probative evidence that a crime took place. And the way the courts have balanced those two interests under the independent source doctrine is to make sure that the police do not profit from their misconduct. So the way that that is achieved is by putting the police in the same position that they would be in if no police error or misconduct occurred. And
so So if there had been any incriminatory statements or incriminating statements or anything else that occurred before they got the search warrant, that information would not be admissible in your position, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Curry, I don't want to interrupt you, but you're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, Your Honor, I suppose I would just say that, just to wrap up what I've been discussing about the independent source doctrine to address Judge Alston's question, is that the basic idea is that when the challenged evidence has an independent source, the suppression of that evidence, as the trial court did here, effectively puts the police and the Commonwealth in a worse position than where they had been if no violation had occurred. The courts do not do that because that creates kind of a gotcha moment for the police, where the second they step even a toe out of line, the probable cause that they had developed independently is preserved so that they can still lawfully obtain the search warrant, as they did in this case, to conduct a search of the residence. And I would like to, unless there are further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions from Judge Alston or Judge Petty?
Thank you.
No.
Okay. Mr. Sullivan, you'll have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, this is Stuart Sullivan, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Cockrell. Since I'm the last person to speak, I'm going to start out being a little bit reactive to something that I've heard in the argument. And a question was posed to Ms. Chernin about the issue of probable cause and if the court were to excise the odor of marijuana that police acquired on their approach to the property, and also to excise the observations that they made during the protective sweep, would we still not be left with probable cause based on things that are in the warrant that Detective Mills put in there, having been informed of certain things prior to the date that this all occurred? Now, what Detective Mills had at that point was an anonymous phone call talking about this home. She had been approached by a litigant in a custody case for the father of these children, and the final bit of information she had was the father of the children saying, "This is what my children have seen in the home." Those are the things that the court was asking about, whether that creates probable cause of itself. Now, this was responded to by Detective Mills in the hearing, and her statement to the court about why she didn't get a warrant at that point was that this was a custody battle, and I'm not going to a magistrate on that level of information given to me in a custody battle. I would note that the Commonwealth, in its briefs in this case, has, I think, taken the position that probable cause did not exist prior to their acquisition of the odor of marijuana at the property that day. And I'm not going to state with precision what the legal test would be, but I believe it to be that whether we can say with great confidence that a magistrate, having been presented with just that information, would issue a warrant, and I think there remains
Mr. Sullivan, we review this de novo, so we're not trying to anticipate what a magistrate would find. It's in our estimation, does the warrant contain or the affidavit contain probable cause? And in that regard, there was no challenge made to the reliability of the information provided to the police prior to their going to the premises.
That is correct. You are correct about that. I would say, however, that having the opportunity to say it, that the reliability of that information, given what was going on and the manner in which it was given to the police, did raise a question about its reliability.
Mr. Sullivan, were you counsel of record at the trial level?
I was, yes, sir.
At the trial level, when the case was heard before the trial judge, And again, I was a trial judge at one point, and I actually understand the circumstance the trial judge may have been confronted with. Was this a search warrant case, or was this a protective search case?
I believe it's more a search warrant case than a. If you're asking me, was it a protective sweep case? I would say that I agree with the Commonwealth, as I did in my brief, that I think the protective sweep and what was acquired pursuant to the protective sweep, I don't agree the protective sweep was proper, but I think what was acquired pursuant to the protective sweep is somewhat a sideshow. I don't think that it is the consequential issue in the case.
That's a little bit different from Ms. Chernin. As I understand,
Ms.
Chernin's
that.
Argument, she was focusing on, I think her term was the outrageousness of the protective sweep.
Well, I'll tell you, Your Honor, I'm not going to use the word outrageous, but what I am going to say is this. We're all guided by a general proposition that reasonableness is the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment. There were conclusions forced on the trial court by the circumstances and also by direct statements that police officers made. And if I could just quickly point to two things that are of high significance, I think, in this record, and they involve observations made by the two people who were part of this foray out to the house that day who were not inside law enforcement. The first, of course, is the guardian ad litem, who did what a guardian ad litem doing a welfare check would do, which is to drive directly up to the house and make herself apparent. She couldn't find the law enforcement. She received an unhappy or angry, I believe is the term in the record, call from Detective Mills, who said, essentially, you have blown our cover. You have given away our position. That phone call concluded, and the next thing that immediately occurred, and this needs to be clear, a clear understanding of this, the social worker, who would also be a person who would be going to a welfare check, was turned to by one of the officers, and this is at what they were calling their staging area, which is not at the house, but around the corner of the house where the whole vice narcotics unit is. They immediately turned to her and said, you stay here, we're going to clear the residence. Now that statement, that illuminating statement as to what they were going to do was made before they approached the house, before the police officers drove to the house and got out of the car. So we are not left.
Mr. Sullivan,
yes,
all of these facts pertain to the protective suite, the initial entry. And going back to Judge Alston's question, we're trying to decide what challenge to the search warrant was made here. And I'm looking at your motion to suppress, I can't find anything in there that would suggest to the trial court that the search warrant affidavit did not provide probable cause.
Well, again, Your Honor, you're correct about that. I'm guided by, I guess, the court, the standard of review on appeal, where the court, I think, is going to apply the correct law to the facts of the case that are found by the trial court. But I can't tell you that I did do that. I can't say that.
So this is the problem I'm having with this case. Everybody's arguing about a protective sweep during which no evidence was found, and nobody challenges the search warrant that was the basis for the discovery of the suppressed evidence. So where does that leave us? Can we remand this back to the trial court to determine whether the search warrant was valid?
Well, I suppose the court could do that, or I suppose the court could apply what it believes to be the correct law to the facts of the case as well. What I would like to say to the court, and I do not deny what the court has said, that was there a direct challenge to the search warrant? There wasn't. What the court does have and what you're confronted with is a situation, given what I've just said, which is straight from the record of the trial court, is police officers announcing an improper purpose to go upon a property. There's no question about that. Again, it's a direct and illuminating statement that they made. It is exactly the sort of behavior that Aprisco, that Jardines, and cases in that vein say is unreasonable conduct by the police. There was absolutely an announced purpose to go into the house. It was announced before they acquired an odor of marijuana. That's what they were doing. Yes, ma'am?
Can I just interrupt? I think it's pretty clear that there was some concerning behavior by law enforcement here, and they may have had ulterior motives and all of that. But I think at the end of the day, we still get down to what in the affidavit, if you remove any of the information that they obtained from what you would argue would be an unlawful entry, if you remove all of that, the affidavit still has enough for probable cause, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, my answer to that would be that the court should excise the acquisition of the odor of marijuana. At the time that that occurred, Ms. Smith was abiding in her home with the right to be secure in her person, houses, papers, and effects. The police were descending on that home, having announced and circumstances supporting that they were going there to investigate and find drugs, to enter the home, they had said, before they smelled marijuana. The facts in the record, if you review it, will indicate that they were on the curtilage, on the front yard, in the front porch of the house at the time that these things occurred, and that should be excised from the warrant as well. The odor of marijuana should be excised from the warrant, as should the observations from the protective sweep.
Okay, assuming we do all of that, doesn't that then leave us with either the trial court or us having to determine whether or not the information that was in the affidavit was sufficiently reliable for a search warrant to be issued? And should we be making that determination, or should the trial court be making that determination on remand?
I think that it does pose the question that somebody needs to determine whether there was probable cause or not.
I'm asking you who.
Well, I think you should. I think this court should do it. And I think that there's grave question about the integrity of that evidence, given the context in which that came up, which was a custody battle, and the only information police had was from anonymous sources or hearsay through a litigant in a custody case.
But there's been no challenge to the credibility of the witnesses providing the information. That issue's not even on the table. So how do we make that determination?
Well, in a probable cause determination, when you say there's no challenge to the credibility, Your Honor, it would seem to speak for itself. I mean, the circumstances
counsel, there is a strong preference for a warrant, and you look at the warrant and what's contained in the four corners of the affidavit,
yeah,
and probable cause is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So I guess the question that we're trying to get an answer to is, once you take out, even assuming that your argument is valid, that information obtained from the arrival of police at the scene and the protective sweep, even when you take all of that out, you've got a significant amount of information that went unchallenged that would seem to support probable cause.
You have three sources of information which would remain in the four corners of the warrant, which would arise within the context, again, of every bit of that information, every single bit of it, coming from either an anonymous, totally unnamed source with no detail whatsoever, or the litigant in a custody battle against the party whose home he wants to be seized.
I guess what's happening, counsel, is that it's actually starting to become circular. That's there. Whether or not it's sufficient enough, we don't have any record to make that determination, and that issue was not challenged at the trial court. So since it's not challenged, how can we say that it's wrong in the context of a Commonwealth appeal?
I think the court does have enough information to make that determination. I'm not sure what the trial court would do to differently to make the determination that this court wouldn't. I mean,
the trial court would say, I've considered the information that's placed in the affidavit. I've listened to the testimony that's been presented here today to support the allegations in the search warrant. I find the information as reliable, and I believe that under the circumstances, the magistrate was not in error in granting the search warrant. That's the analysis that would usually occur at the trial court.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that this court is free to make, in these, with the standard of review that's applicable in these cases, to determine how the facts apply to the law of the case.
Mr. Sullivan, why shouldn't we make this a little simpler than it appears to be, and simply say the trial court suppressed evidence discovered during a search pursuant to a validly issued search warrant without any analysis as to why that search warrant was improper, and therefore it erred in reverse? Why isn't that the simplest answer to this whole problem?
Well, Judge, I think because we are going back and forth probably with the same sorts of things, because I think that the court is entitled to look at the integrity of the search warrant and what's in the search warrant, and that when the law is properly applied to the facts, as this court can do, that there was not probable cause.
Else, can you cite to any cases that you're aware of? And I understand this might catch you a little bit off balance, but are you able to cite to any cases which basically suggest that the appellate court should make an independent review of the reliability of the information provided in an affidavit and basically overrule a trial court's assessment of that information?
No, I can't cite a case to the court as I sit here. Probable cause determinations are always made on written facts. They're there in the warrant affidavit now. And
I guess the closest you would get to that is if that determination by the trial court was clearly erroneous or something, some extreme standard of review. And obviously, and I appreciate your concession, we don't have that here.
No, we don't.
Counsel, thank you very much. We gave you a little extra time to answer Judge Alston's questions. Do Judge Alston or Judge Petty, do either of you have any additional questions for Mr. Sullivan?
None for me.
I think we've batted Mr. Sullivan around enough. He did a very good job.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Curry, you've got 4 minutes left of the 8 minutes that you wanted to reserve, so
that's
use your 4 minutes wisely.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Curry, before you get started. Why is Judge Petty's suggestion as to the resolution of this matter the most efficient and the best way to resolve this case? So we have a search warrant that's unchallenged. The search warrant thereby is considered to be good. We need not get into the protective sleep analysis, reverse trial court. Why isn't that the best way to resolve this case?
Your Honor, my response is that is the best way to resolve this case.
Way to go, Judge Petty.
I think that that's been the Commonwealth's position from the beginning. I think at one point in the trial court, without so much as saying it, the Commonwealth said that we're talking about we're two different things. They're talking about a protective sweep, but no one is addressing the warrant. And the trial court's letter, opinion, and order never seemed to address the fact that a search warrant was issued. There's almost no record.
But I think a fair reading of the record, counsel, is the reason why the trial court got frustrated is because as the case was presented to the trial court, it was a protective sweep case, and then on the tail end, the government tried to make it a search warrant case. I think that's the problem in the case.
Sure. I understand that, Your Honor, but I think the Commonwealth fairly presented the probable cause and the search warrant issue in its response to the motion to suppress.
Mr. Curry, if we do that, would that allow the defendants to file a supplemental motion to suppress challenging the search warrant?
Your Honor, my interpretation of the statutes regarding Commonwealth appeals is that the defendants in this case had, pursuant to 19.2.401, they had the ability to file a cross appeal from any order which the Commonwealth could appeal. And I think that would have been the opportunity had for the these defendants to make challenges to...
How could the defendants have done that when the trial court didn't make a determination on the search warrant? How can you appeal something that the trial judge didn't decide?
Well, I think then that would raise a 5A18 issue. If that is a finding, or if there is an issue with the warrant that they want to assign cross error to in a Commonwealth appeal, then they would be the cross appellant, and then they would have the same obligations to preserve and the error below and to obtain a ruling that was erroneous below.
I think even the trial court was of the view that this was not a search warrant case, it was a protective sweep case. So why wouldn't the defendants be in a position to raise the validity of the search warrant once the case is remanded if we agree with you that the search warrant provided an independent basis at this point, I guess?
I'm sorry, is your question, Judge Alston, why are Smith and Cockrell allowed to challenge the assertions
the search
contained
warrant.
In the affidavit? And the search warrant? My position, the Commonwealth's position, would be that under 19.2401, their failure to raise that issue in the trial court and to raise it here would make that effectively law of the case, that there would have been an issue that was appealed by the Commonwealth's assignments of error that raised the issue of the validity of the search warrant that was the source of the evidence that was obtained that the defendants sought to suppress. And they have missed their opportunity to appeal. And under the law of the case doctrine, a failure to appeal unfavorable rulings makes those rulings law of the case going forward.
Well, it hasn't. Excuse me, Mr. Curry. So they haven't done a cross appeal, but when it goes back to the trial court for the case to be heard, isn't there a recent Virginia Supreme Court case that says they can bring up a challenge again?
Yes, Your Honor, but I assume are you referring to a challenge on appeal?
Correct, on a direct appeal.
Right. I don't think that they are foreclosed on appeal from challenging. I think they would be have an uphill battle to prove that this issue was timely preserved when the relevant rulings were made in the trial court. But I don't want to confuse the court into thinking that the Commonwealth's position is that they have no right, further right to appeal. They even have the right to appeal the issues in this case on direct appeal.
Right.
You know,
okay.
Should this matter be reversed and remanded for a trial and a conviction, of course.
Okay, Mr. Curry, your time is up.
Okay.
Judge Alston, Judge Petty, any other questions?
No, thank you.
I said I wouldn't dare ask another.
Okay. Well, thank you all, counsel. You've all done a great job with this case, and it'll be submitted to the court for consideration. And.